Before we dive in, I want to take a moment to thank you for being with us here at The World. We are well aware of all the competition for your time and attention, and we are grateful that we are your source for global news. We hope that you find our work clarifying and believe like we do that independent, fact-based journalism is essential for democracy and can help us all gain perspective and make sense out of the noise. We're able to bring you critical reporting on international events because listeners like you support our work. From now until June 14th, we are fundraising with a goal of $25,000. Every gift counts and helps us cover the costs, from reporting trips and keeping our team safe to maintaining audio equipment, all so we can focus on sharing stories from around the world with nuance and with care. We hope you'll consider creating a monthly donation and joining the listeners who help sustain our newsroom year-round. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to contribute. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for being with The World. Now, on to the show. Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world. to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you. Today on The World, a controversial study in Britain will infect volunteers with the coronavirus. It now has a green light.
These learnings of the immune system also need to translate to the wide population.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, we'll hear about a new mural in New York that makes a connection between a man's death in Egypt to movements like Black Lives Matter.
We are getting shot at by the same ammunition, whether it's Ferguson or Cairo. Our struggles are the same.
And have you seen Lupin, the French Netflix series? A thriller and a hit that also shows France's diversity in fresh ways.
It's not diverse for the sake of diversity, you know, when you have the token black or the token person of North African background or the token Muslims.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Cheers and applause today in Johannesburg, South Africa, where the country's first coronavirus vaccines were administered. Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital is one of 18 sites in the country where South Africans can get the single-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Healthcare workers like Tembi Kobotlo were first in line.
I've been waiting for this vaccine to come into our country, and I'm very happy about it.
She's a nurse in a COVID-19 ward there.
The first wave came and I wasn't infected. The second wave came, I wasn't infected. So we don't know. Maybe when the third wave came, I might have it. But I'm just happy to have it.
South Africa's national rollout begins after a complicated and disappointing start. South Africa received over 1 million units of the two-dose AstraZeneca vaccine at the beginning of February. But then new research showed that the AstraZeneca shot has limited efficacy against the coronavirus variant that's dominant in South Africa, causing the country to shift abruptly from AstraZeneca to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. David Makura is premier of Gauteng province.
We follow science. When the scientists said to us that AstraZeneca wouldn't work as it would have been anticipated with the new variant, we had to adapt and make a new plan.
It remains somewhat unclear what will happen with those unused AstraZeneca doses. President Cyril Ramaphosa has indicated that they would be offered to other countries on the continent through the African Union. In Cape Town, Ramaphosa himself joined those being inoculated. While the exact vaccination plans are still in development, the country aims to eventually vaccinate two-thirds of people, or around 40 million South Africans. Today, the UK approved the world's first coronavirus human challenge study. In other words, volunteers will be exposed to the virus for research. In this case, adults between the ages of 18 and 30 will be exposed to the coronavirus in a controlled environment, and researchers will track the volunteers to learn more about the virus. Dr. Andrew Catchpole is the chief scientific officer at HVIVO, one of the organizations leading the study. Give us a basic rundown here, Dr. Catchpole. How do human challenge studies work, and why are they important?
Human challenge studies work by deliberately administering experimentally a very small controlled amount of the virus to each of these participants. So unlike field trials where you have no control of the amount of virus you're exposed to, in these studies we have absolute control of the level and amount of virus that we're administering.
In this case, how many participants will be involved and what precisely are you hoping to learn?
The study will be up to 90 people, and I say up to because we will deliberately be stopping the trial as soon as we've achieved our primary aim of identifying what is the smallest amount of virus that we can give. We've been monitoring volunteers very closely, even before we administer the virus, so we'll be able to see real-time live changes of the immune response as they're exposed to the virus. Also, what does the disease look like in asymptomatic individuals? And of course, it's those individuals which can cause the pandemic to continue spreading because they're still walking around unaware that they have the virus. We'll be able to learn a great deal about that demographic in these trials.
I mean, given that we still don't know all the long-term effects of being infected by COVID-19, is this a concern when conducting the study? I mean, we have seen vigorous young athletic types succumb to it.
So this is true. This is why we are being extremely careful about whom we actually enroll onto these trials. So, of course, age is one factor, but of course, it's not the only factor. We will be looking very much more detailedly into their overall health, as well as their ethnicity, for example. All of these factors will be combined to make sure we're only enrolling the very most safe persons to inoculate in these trials.
Yeah, to that point, when we first reported on your company getting funding from the British government back in October, you were considering whether to exclude volunteers of color from being part of the initial stage of the trial because you said there's data to suggest an increased risk from COVID to people of color. Our reporting included some substantial criticism of that idea, including that it could marginalize and exclude those communities and just add to mistrust fueled by decades of racist clinical trials and experiments. Where did you finally land? Will people of color be included in the initial phase?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's no ethnicity barriers onto our trial, and that seems very much where we wanted it to be. These vaccines need to be global vaccines to the world. So fortunately, in the months that's intervened since we started this, a lot more data has emerged.
What kind of data? What made you change your mind?
For example, it is true that some ethnicities are more at risk of severe disease and potentially even death from COVID-19. But what has emerged is it's not as simple as that. It's not directly, solely ethnicity, i.e. genetics, that play a factor in that. The socio-demographic conditions of individuals and how they're living all bears an influence on this. There are many factors which play into the risk profiles for this.
And how will mutant variations, specifically the one first detected in the UK, how will they be factored into the study? And is that, in fact, one of the goals?
With these variants emerging, it is clear that whilst these first-generation vaccines that are being rolled out are fantastic and it's great that we've got those vaccines, it's also clear that they're not going to be the sole answer. They're not going to enable us to eradicate this virus from the human population. We're certainly going to need updates to the vaccines and potentially even completely new vaccines. So what we'll be doing on this first trial is we are starting with a virus that emerged in the UK late spring and then was dominant until the autumn time when the variant started to emerge. However, we're immediately also then looking to see, can we then continue with these studies with one or more of the variant viruses that emerge? We'll be able to then transition a variant virus into this program very much quicker because of the learnings from this first trial.
Dr. Andrew Catchpole is the chief scientific officer at hVIVO, one of the organizations leading the world's first COVID-19 human challenge study. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It's been 10 years since the start of the Libyan Revolution. That was in 2011. After the fall of longtime Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi, Libya's former rebel groups began turning on each other. And what began as a movement for change and democracy quickly descended into chaos and eventually civil war. But this week, perhaps some room for hope. Libya has a new interim government formed by opposing factions following a UN-backed effort to reunite the country. Emadeddin Badi is a Libyan political analyst with the Atlantic Council's Middle East Initiative. Thanks for joining us, Emad. Just give us a quick snapshot of the situation on the ground in Libya today.
In terms of the situation on the ground, institutionally speaking, it's still as it was in 2015, roughly, with two separate governments or factions controlling Western and Eastern Libya.
So after half a dozen years or so of two competing governments, what has that meant? What is the upshot for the Libyan people?
That has meant that in terms of actual services, in terms of actual security, etc., there's been a complete devolution of authority to the local level. Libyans are by and large, no longer looking at national level authority to address their needs. They're either looking at local stakeholders like municipalities or actually taking it upon themselves to provide their own services, really. You've got people that purchase their own satellite internet, their own generator, dig their own wells for water, basically try and be as independent from the state as possible. The state has not really, when I say the state, I mean it's the competing national authorities, but those haven't really made any efforts towards actually improving governance, because they've been far more invested in actually plundering state coffers and controlling the levers of patronage that Gaddafi left us with.
So the UN-backed leadership vote happened. Libya has this new government. What will it determine then, its ability to govern Libya?
I think this new government is essentially a bit hampered by design in its ability to actually rule all of Libya or improve services across all of Libya. First of all, it is hampered in terms of timeline, because it is supposed to be just an executive authority that will bring Libya to elections in December, which is, to be fair, an ambitious, actually, timeline for things. And then the other facet is that the government is supposed to also somewhat placate all of the competing political factions by including them. But if it does that, it might lose its ability to actually function as a government, since everyone will be investing in entrenching themselves and plundering state coffers once more.
That sounds like a huge challenge. What do you think is a likely outcome? And do you think it'll bring Libya any closer to peace and stability?
I personally want to be hopeful, being Libyan, but the analyst in me is more cynical. I haven't seen exactly the lessons learned from the kind of the Skhirat agreement in 2015, where there was an internationally sponsored agreement to actually bring about a government of national accord. In fact, there are kind of new factors that make the road ahead far more arduous for this government, namely in the form of foreign interventionism, because you now have full-fledged interventions by Turkey, by Russia, by the UAE, some of which are to a degree covert, but everyone knows at this stage that these countries are actively involved. And given their influence is military, or their presence is military on the ground, then essentially, regardless almost of what this government is doing, this is bound at some point to trigger another round of internationalized conflict. So the outlook, from my perspective, analytically speaking, is a bit bleak. It would be a miracle if this government manages to actually bring us to election in December.
How do you think the Biden administration will be approaching the Libya situation? And what changes in U.S. policy do you think we might see?
I think the Biden administration, there won't be that much of a change. I mean, there are definitely now far more challenges than the Trump administration had, albeit it didn't really have a policy. But now there's even more challenges for the Biden administration. I don't think it will particularly prioritize the Libyan conflict. Perhaps there will be far more of a kind of cohesive policy, in the sense that the State Department, the Pentagon, and the White House won't have diverging or contradictory footprints to what they want in the country. Whether that kind of cohesion or coherence in policy will translate into actually tangible outcomes for the U.S. is a bit of a stretch, because you've got other countries that are involved in Libya.
So, Ahmed, when you look back over the course of 10 years at everything that's happened in Libya, I mean, it's existed in this unsettled state, to say the least. What does give you hope for a better future in Libya?
I think we have nothing else to do but hope, in a way. And I think the night is darkest before dawn. So, unfortunately, it's almost like the fact that there's so much misery, so much injustice, so much impunity, etc. Those factors are still there, unaddressed, etc. I think there is bound to be a reckoning with all this. The only thing that we should be, that unfortunately I'm focusing on and other people I know are focusing on, is trying to either right the course of the revolution, or if another round of revolts or protests erupts, just not make the same mistakes again. Because a lot of the mistakes that were made weren't made by the young people that led the revolution in 2011 as much as they were made by the far older political elite and the international community that didn't really have a plan for post-revolutionary Libya.
Ahmed Adin Badi is a Libyan political analyst speaking with us from Toronto. Thank you very much for your time, Ahmed.
Thank you.
Later this hour, a personal reflection on what the last 10 years have been like from Libyan poet Khaled Matawa. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Public art should be seen. Somewhat difficult right now with the advice to stay indoors. There is a new mural up in New York City. It honors an Egyptian-American man who died last year in Egypt. As The World's Rupa Shenoy reports, this homage is intended to remind people that the U.S. should uphold human rights here at home and abroad.
The mural is going up on the side of a bodega in an especially diverse part of Astoria, New York. It's near Little Egypt, across from some low-income housing, and shares a wall with an outdoor community fridge where people can drop off or pick up food. Leading the project is Brandy Jones of Black Village Arts, a group that promotes arts education.
If you're turning the corner, probably the first thing you would notice is Mustafa's face.
She means Mustafa Kasim, a taxi driver who lived nearby. In 2013, he visited family in Egypt and was caught in the police response to a sit-in.
It's very similar to stories that happen here, especially with the wave of protests that we had in June and July. I personally have so many friends themselves that were unlawfully arrested at peaceful protests.
In Egypt, though, Kasim was held for 5 years without charge. Then in 2018, he was sentenced to 15 years in a high-security prison for being a spy.
I, like probably a lot of people, also thought that this wouldn't be able to happen because he was an American citizen.
That's what Kasim thought, too, that being American meant the U.S. government would eventually see to his release. Mohammed Sultan met Kasim in an Egyptian prison. He says Kasim was a small, soft-spoken man with a gentle soul.
I remember the first time I laid eyes on him in this like underground dungeon. And people were like, this is the other American that's in the prison. And I remember thinking, what the hell is a man like that doing in a place like this?
The two men talked whenever they could about life back in the U.S. Sultan, an Egyptian-American Midwesterner, was also arrested in 2013. He had been protesting the Egyptian government. He was tortured as a high-profile political prisoner. Sultan wrote a letter to President Obama that was published in the New York Times, and the administration secured his release in 2015. Sultan had to leave Kasim behind.
And I promised him, I told him that I will do everything in my power to try and get him out of prison.
Sultan, a human rights advocate, started the Freedom Initiative in Washington, D.C. to represent prisoners in Egypt and Saudi Arabia. He lobbied incessantly and had some big wins. Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and President Trump called for Kasim's release. In December 2019, Sultan says the State Department told him they were close to freeing Kasim. Sultan called Kasim's wife and two children in Egypt to cautiously share the good news. Kasim died before anything could happen. He was on a hunger strike, protesting for his release, and his body gave out. That was January 13th, 2020. He was 54.
I had to give him literally a call a week later to give my condolences. And his teenage daughter was rightfully screaming at me. She said, "You told us he was going to get released. You told us. You just called us last week. You told us that there was progress." And I literally had no words. All I can say is I'm sorry.
Sultan went into a period of deep introspection and nearly closed the Freedom Initiative. He felt defeated. Sultan's father and other relatives have been jailed in Egypt because of his activism. But then Sultan says he remembered that there are tens of thousands of other Mustafa Kasims, prisoners still in Egyptian jails, including a few other Americans that Sultan represents. They relaunched the Freedom Initiative with a new logo that's a silhouette of Mustafa Kasim's face. And they commissioned the mural in Kasim's hometown.
His death sort of revived our reasoning for existence. His name will be remembered, not just as a failure of U.S. foreign policy, but to remind people that it's not just him.
Sultan is encouraged by signals of support from the Biden administration, and he vows to hold it accountable. The U.S. subsidizes Egypt's military with $1.4 billion in aid annually. Sultan says that money is leverage the U.S. should use to get Egypt to change. It's also important to him to link Kasim's death to human rights concerns within the U.S.
We are getting beaten by the same batons. We are getting shot at by the same ammunition, whether it's Ferguson or Cairo. Our struggles are the same.
At the top of the Astoria mural, it says, "One struggle, many faces." Below Kasim's face are the words, "Justice for Mustafa Kasim." Around him are birds and stars. Beyond that are figures of people holding signs that say, "I can't breathe," and "end gun violence." And there's someone crouching behind an umbrella, a symbol of pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong. Artist Brandy Jones says the mural sends a universal message.
It's a human rights issue, not a particular person, no matter their socioeconomic background, ethnicity, or nationality issue. It should matter to all of us.
She says advocating for human rights anywhere should mean advocating for human rights everywhere. For the world, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
That's a remake of the song Biko, Peter Gabriel's 1980 protest song written as a tribute to Steve Biko, the South African anti-apartheid activist who was murdered in police custody in 1977. Biko was the author and founder of the Black Consciousness Movement.
We believe that in our country there shall be no minority, there shall be no majority, there shall just be people.
In 1977, Biko was on his way home from Cape Town with his friend Peter Jones. They were both arrested under the Terrorism Act. While detained, Biko sustained a massive brain hemorrhage. Police claimed he was on a hunger strike. When his friend Peter Jones, who was also detained, heard of Biko's death, he was devastated. Here he is on the 40th anniversary of Biko's death.
And I just sat there with what I can only describe as a huge hole in my soul.
It was 20 years later that the police admitted that they had killed Steve Biko. He became a symbol of black resistance. Peter Gabriel remade Biko with help from 25 musicians from around the globe, including Angélique Kidjo and Yo-Yo Ma. It was recorded virtually as part of Playing for Change's Song Around the World initiative and to raise money for organizations working on social justice issues. Gabriel wanted to remake his tribute song to continue raising awareness about racism around the world. He said, quote, "Although the white minority government has gone in South Africa, the racism around the world that apartheid represented has not." You can watch a video of Peter Gabriel's remake of Biko at our Twitter. We're at The World. Sure, you are used to listening to The World, but how about reading The World and the stories we're following along with your morning coffee? Sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World, on our website, theworld.org/newsletters. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Hi, it's Marco. Here at The World, we ended 2020 strong by raising over $100,000 to support the show and this podcast. Thanks to you and these listeners: Christina Screehot, Pascal Levinson, William Reynolds, John Allison, Donald Camp, Leslie Meadowcroft, George Blossom, Jay and Patrice Ahrens, Georgi Grigoriance, and Marian Mon. Thanks for your support throughout 2020 as we dive headfirst into 2021. After a massive explosion rocked Beirut last year, there were protests. Security forces hit this Lebanese man with rubber bullets.
I joined the streets again. It was quite an easy call. It was, okay, if I stay home now, they win.
So he jumped back in. But now a new report reveals a surprising backstory to those bullets. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The French mystery thriller series Lupin dropped on Netflix last month to critical acclaim. It's inspired by a popular collection of French stories published in the early 1900s, Arsène Lupin, Gentleman Burglar. Lupin, the new Netflix series, re-envisions the novels in the present day, with the protagonist as a Senegalese immigrant. So into this quintessential French narrative is injected themes of race and who is seen and not seen in French society. For some perspectives on the series, I've got Rim Sara Alouan in Toulouse on the line. She studies French civil liberties, particularly around religion and race. Welcome back, Rim Sara.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Rim Sara, Lupin is socially conscious. It's also exciting and a lot of fun. How big is it in France right now?
It is one of the most watched show on Netflix. It's amazing. It's so refreshing.
So let me help our listeners here. This series has got the pedigree of the thriller novels from the early 1900s, where the character is a French gentleman burglar with a top hat and a monocle. So he becomes the animating spirit in the Netflix series for a Senegalese guy named Hassan Diop. In the present day, he's played by the terrific actor Omar Sy.
Imaginez, vous héritez d'un trésor.
As a boy, Hassan is raised by his father, who has immigrated to France from Senegal, and the dad has a job as a chauffeur for a really wealthy family, but he gets framed for stealing a necklace from the family. And so the story of the series is launched, with Hassan, the son, trying years later to learn what the truth is of what happened. There is something else going on with this story, and I'm wondering what that is. Why is this so popular?
It is popular because I think it's the first time that there is a TV show that looks like France. It's very diverse, but it's not diverse for the sake of diversity, you know, when you have the token black or the token person of North African background or the token Muslims. They are just characters from different backgrounds with their stories who are just doing their jobs, who are just part of the story. And I was surprised and shocked because at first I was like, okay, it's called Lupin. I've read the book when I was a kid. And when I started to watch, I was like, wait, it's amazing. There are characters who look like today's society, cops who played by actors of North African backgrounds, but it's not mentioned. It's there. And that's the way it should be.
Lupin does show racism in France. Hassan, the protagonist, as a boy, he faces racist abuse at the house where his dad works. He deals with it at boarding school. And finally, he even exploits French racism for his own ends and some of his magic and cunning. Have you ever seen a story like this in French TV or film before that actually highlights the casual racism of the French bourgeoisie?
Usually, really, it's the white bourgeoisie saving Muslims, saving black people. You know, this kind of savior complex. And in very terrible manners, quite racist, to be honest. You know, the motto of the show, if you look at Omar Sy's tweet line, because that was really the motto to promote the show, is you looked at them, but you don't see them, you know, talking about all of these people, usually of immigrants who come to this country. Unfortunately, many of them are poor and, you know, got jobs that nobody in France wants. They are cleaner. They are maids. They are sorely needed into society. And we saw that with the COVID crisis. Without these people, this country would not have been able to survive. But we don't see them. We don't see that existence. And it was perfectly shown in that show. I mean, I have witnessed this kind of attitude towards, you know, rich people and their maids, you know, or their drivers. I have seen that with my own eyes. And what was depicted is actually a reflection of reality.
You give me the perfect segue to this next question, Rim Sara. The best-selling book by French economist Thomas Piketty, Capital in the 21st Century, is unmissable in the frame in one scene in the series. Piketty's book, for those who don't know, it's about wealth and inequality in Europe and America over the past 250 years. French viewers probably will not have missed seeing that. What's going on there, do you think? How does that tie into what's happening in Lupin?
Well, if you follow the debate again, you probably heard about all the issues regarding discrimination, racism, police brutality. And unfortunately, that's something that governments, both from the right wing, the centrist, as well as neo-Republican lefties, refuse to admit. And every time you have someone, you know, calling out government policies on these matters, they are accused of importing a racial war from the United States. That's the kind of narrative currently going on in this country, and it's dangerous.
It occurs to me this makes Lupin all the more impressive as a commentary on race in France today. Do you attribute this to Netflix? I mean, could this have happened on one of the legacy French TV networks?
I do not think this kind of show would have happened if it was a French movie production company. Hollywood goes after money, right? The color of the dollar, you need to go after the color of the dollar. And if diversity and telling positive stories about minorities, about people of colors, etc., is good because it makes money, they will do it. In France, it's more complicated. Clearly, this, like Lupin, is the living proof that, you know, having a diverse cast, a wonderful story, a reinvention of a classical character of French literature works. It makes money. We need to work from the ground. But are the French ready for that? The French people are, definitely. I'm not sure about the elite.
So at a time when far-right nationalist politician Marine Le Pen is said to be gaining the ground needed to remove Emmanuel Macron from the presidency, how big of a deal would you say it is for France that a black African Muslim is the inheritor of Arsène Lupin's legacy?
Well, Marine Le Pen is the past. You know, whether it's the far right or the current administration or the neo-Republican left, they believe in a certain idea of France that does not exist anymore. Today, people of immigrant background are French. They were born and raised here. This is their country too. I don't think the far right is going to survive, but unfortunately, they are very loud and their ID spread quite fast because we allow them to spread quite fast. And definitely something must be done. Otherwise, the majority will be a victim of this kind of toxic narrative.
We often turn to Rimsara Alawan to talk about French culture and politics. We've been chatting about the new Netflix series, Lupin. You got to check it out. It's really good. Rimsara, thank you as always.
Merci. Thank you so much.
Lebanon has seen many protests in recent years, with people taking to the streets to protest unemployment, massive trash pileups, and the deadly explosion at the Beirut port last summer that killed at least 200 people. At times, Lebanese security forces have responded to protests with what many have called a disproportionate level of force. That's according to a new report by Amnesty International. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari with more.
Last August, just 2 days after the explosion that rocked Beirut, French President Emmanuel Macron visited the city. He toured devastated neighborhoods as his bodyguards struggled to avoid tripping over glass and debris. In the commotion, one woman elbowed her way past Macron's bodyguards and got right up next to him.
Hold us accountable for this entire mess and crisis!
The woman asked Macron to stop giving aid money to the same corrupt government officials who brought Lebanon to where it is today.
Your anger is my source of optimism.
Macron pledged to help the Lebanese people. Then he gave the woman a big hug. France sent teams of experts to help search for missing people. It sent humanitarian aid. It turns out the French also sent equipment that Lebanon's security forces used to crush protests. That's according to a report by Amnesty International published late last month. It concludes that Lebanese security forces unlawfully fired French-made rubber bullets and tear gas canisters at protesters at close range.
You know, a number of protesters have suffered from serious injuries.
Diala Haider is with Amnesty International in Beirut.
People lost their eyes and many had to undergo many surgeries and are still undergoing many surgeries because of rubber bullets hitting different parts in their face.
Security forces fired directly at protesters. They also fired indiscriminately from moving vehicles. It was not hard to find evidence. Protesters took videos of police actions and posted them on social media. In this one, security forces shove a Human Rights Watch researcher to the ground as she's filming.
Yeah, is this my phone?
Amnesty International says France sold equipment, including tear gas, rubber bullets, grenade launchers, and armored personnel carriers to Lebanon as recently as last year. Jean-Georges Prince is one of the protesters who was injured.
I got shot with a close-range rubber bullet, so it tore my lower lip. I got 56 stitches and a five-hour surgery. And I still don't have mobility to my lower lip a year later.
Before the protests, Prince owned a tattoo parlor in Beirut. He loved his job, he says, but money was tight. He was frustrated by the way Lebanese officials mishandled one crisis after another. That's why when the protests began, he says, he was right on the front lines.
I felt like it was now or never.
The protesters got beatings here and there, he says. That was kind of expected. But that night in January last year, when he got shot, it kind of felt something had shifted.
I was shocked. I was stunned that they actually started shooting at us.
Prince says several of his teeth were broken and he had to go on a liquid diet for 3 months. He lost about 30 pounds, he says. But soon he was right back at the protests.
I remember very clearly the day after they took my sutures off, I joined the streets again. It was quite an easy call. It was, okay, if I stay home now, they win.
Throughout the protests, Prince had closed down his business. He'd managed to financially stay afloat for about a year. But then, slowly, he realized that his activism wasn't sustainable.
I got to a place where I was really between a rock and a hard place. I was, okay, I need to fight for my country, but also I need to be able to stay alive.
He moved to Dubai, where he now lives with his wife. He works for an ad agency, but he misses being a tattoo artist. For Prince, the fight in Lebanon has evolved. He says most protesters have come to the conclusion that they can't win just by showing up on the streets and by burning tires. They need to organize behind the scenes to bring about real change.
We're trying to find a way to increase our numbers so that eventually down the line, we can actually be a part of the system.
Be part of a system, for example, by putting up their own candidates in local elections. As for the report by Amnesty International, Prince says it would be unfair to blame France for what happened to him.
You know, at the end of the day, I think every police in the world has to be equipped. And I think what the French did was just make sure that our police was equipped.
It's the duty of the state, he says, to make sure its security forces use anti-riot gear responsibly. Still, Prince considers himself lucky. He knows other protesters who lost their eyes or suffered even more serious injuries. He says one person died recently in the city of Tripoli after being shot with live ammunition. Prince says he will continue to fight for a better Lebanon from outside the country and looks forward to the day he can return. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Earlier in the show today, we were talking about the challenges facing Libya's transitional government 10 years after the revolution that toppled dictator Muammar Gaddafi. We're going to take another look now at this anniversary from a different angle, a poetic one. In his latest collection, Fugitive Atlas, poet Khaled Matawa grapples with the memory of the uprising and what came after. Matawa joins us now from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thank you for being with us again to mark this anniversary, Khaled.
Marco, it's great to be with you again. I love your program.
In your collection, Fugitive Atlas, there's a poem you wrote shortly after the death of Gaddafi. It's called After 42 Years, and it ends with this powerful line, "There is no after until we pray for all our dead." So now we're 10 years on. How does that line read to you now?
Well, unfortunately, we haven't prayed for all the dead. By that, I mean accepting a responsibility for all those who've passed and truly mourning the loss of the other. And this is what I worried about, that in the fighting, we will not recognize the dead of the others as worthy of the same sort of commemoration. And even when the death of Gaddafi, he was tossed into a kind of refrigerator, like a captured dog or something. And that seemed to just sort of reverberate. Really what we're talking about is really national reconciliation and admittance of all the facts of the violence that had taken place before and after the rebellion. And it's maybe happening slowly, but it's not done until it's done.
Later in the same collection, Khaled, you reprise that poem and the feelings you had right after Gaddafi's death. The new poem is titled After 42 Years Revisited, about what came after those initial feelings of liberation following Gaddafi's overthrow. What changed, though?
The new poem is very difficult to read because there are three different voices talking at the same time. Mm. One of the voices is actually a passage from one of Gaddafi's short stories where he said, you know, to remove me is very easy. It's actually when a mob is in charge that's more difficult. And in a sense, when everybody is a revolutionary, then you have or a dictator, then you can't have the country put together. The other are the people that are caught in the middle, who are saying we had salaries, we had a good, decent situation. Now you have a revolution and you blew it all up. And then you had people sort of like me who hoped for a revolution, but never really succeeded in managing to actually influence the events beyond the courses of violence that people took. But that doesn't mean that we say, oh, no, let's go back and have a situation like Gaddafi, or that we need another Gaddafi, which is another call, or the direction Egypt took, unfortunately, which is to have a dictatorship worse than the one they had before. So all of these are not options. But in any case, a lot of people who are neither nor get caught in the middle. As much as they wanted a better future, they ended up having, in some ways, a worse situation.
Right. You know, that thinking about those people in the middle is maybe why your collection, Fugitive Atlas, concludes with a poem about your daughter looking toward the future. What is the hope that you lean on, Khaled, when you look toward the future for Libya? Is there a line or a stanza maybe that gets at that?
There is a short stanza from a poem that I wrote for a filmmaker, a friend of mine. All who wear a mortal mold rise as the sun their father rose. Let it gird, not break your heart. The world's amends, the toil imposed. There is work to be done to amend the world. And that's the hope. We have a role to play. All of Libyans have a role to play. Things are improving slightly in Libya, but also people are aware that it takes work to fix the country. And we in America are living a similar moment. There's been a lot of damage since January 6th. We have a lot of work to do in both countries.
Khaled Matawa is a poet and professor at the University of Michigan. His latest collection is Fugitive Atlas. Thank you very much for your time today, Khaled.
Thank you, Marco. It's good to be with you again.
In Turkey this week, officials have detained more than 700 Kurds. Some arrested include members of the pro-Kurdish opposition People's Democratic Party, or HDP, an opposition political party with more than 50 seats in the Turkish parliament. The arrests are a response to a weekend Turkish military raid on a cave complex in northern Iraq held by the PKK. The PKK, the Kurdish militant group that spent the past 40 years fighting to create an independent Kurdistan. The raid was an attempt to save 13 Turkish hostages who had been held by the PKK for several years, but had failed to save them. Reporter Duri Biskaran in Istanbul explains what happened.
On February 13th, the Turkish military attempted to rescue about 13 hostages who had been kept by the PKK in this cave complex for about 5 to 6 years. The Turkish government had been in touch with these hostages. They knew that they were alive. They were in touch with their families as well. And in this attempted rescue operation, the PKK executed the hostages. Their bodies were then found in the caves later by the military with gunshots to the head. So after this happened, it was really a big deal in Turkey, because Turkey has been doing these cross-border operations against the PKK in northern Iraq and northern Syria. It's kind of seen as a infringement on the autonomy of those countries, but Turkey argues it has to do this because of the threat that the PKK poses to Turkish security.
So more than 700 Kurds arrested across Turkey. What are they being accused of, Duri?
Right. So what the HDP tells me is that this is generally what happens after a crisis. Activists, civil society, opposition politicians, they'll be rounded up, they'll be questioned. Most will be released. Not everyone is going to be arrested and booked.
So HDP, that's the People's Democratic Party. They sit in the Turkish parliament. Those 700 people, though, are they all members of the HDP?
No, it's I believe about 100 of them are members of the HDP. It's really one of those things that happens actually somewhat frequently. But what we do know is that in speeches, Erdogan has been doubling down on this rhetoric, accusing the HDP of ties to the PKK. And what this glosses over is that the HDP is the third most popular political party in the entire country. I mean, they regularly get about 10% of the vote in parliamentary elections. And while the PKK uses violence to try and jostle for Kurdish autonomy, the HDP publicly endorses a peaceful diplomatic resolution to the conflict. They won't condemn the PKK directly, but they condemn the methods. They do want Kurdish people in southeastern Turkey to have more freedom to express their identity. And that's kind of where they get into a difficult situation.
Yeah, so explain that, because President Erdogan has now lashed out at the U.S., accusing it of supporting Kurdish militants. What's behind that?
This was interesting. The first statement on the operation released by the State Department said that if the PKK is responsible for this attack, then the U.S. will condemn it. It was kind of this conditional response. And Turkish officials were furious. They summoned the ambassador, and later that day, the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, called the Turkish foreign minister and reiterated that, yes, the U.S. believes that the PKK terrorists bear responsibility here. And the reason that this is so sensitive is this was like the first test for the Biden administration to see where it stands on the PKK. Turkey wants a hardline approach because the U.S. is backing Kurdish militias in Iraq and Syria to rout out ISIS members. They have since the Obama administration, and the U.S. and Turkey offer completely different narratives on whether these Kurdish militias that the U.S. backs have strong ties to the PKK. Turkey sees the U.S. as arming terrorists on their doorstep, even though the two countries are NATO allies, and the U.S. still sees these Kurdish militias as a longtime partner and an ally they don't want to drop. I mean, these are the groups that liberated the Yazidis in Sinjar, some really intense battles.
So had those Turkish hostages who were killed over the weekend, had they originally been abducted in northern Iraq or in Turkey and then taken to Iraq?
They were kidnapped from Turkey. They were largely junior police officers and military members.
Reporter Duri Buscaran speaking with us from Istanbul. Thank you very much, Duri.
Thank you.
Every day we bring voices from around the world to your radio. Right now, though, we're going to bring you radio from around the world, an online project called Radio Garden. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier.
As I first check out Radio Garden's website, I'm hit with pure nostalgia. Like I'm back in 2005, discovering Google Earth for the first time. A 3D satellite globe pops up and zooms right into Boston, where I am now. Some jazz playing on a nearby college station this Wednesday morning. Each station is displayed as a bright green dot, and as I scroll around the globe, there are thousands of them. So if I cross the Atlantic and zoom into Barcelona, I click the green dot and a station called 80s Super Dance Floor plays. I can pick from a couple different stations in the city, but instead, let's head south and click on an FM station in Ghana. You get the picture. Radio Garden lets you listen to live radio from anywhere in the world. We're talking about more than 10,000 stations, spanning every continent except Antarctica. There are clear clusters around big cities, but also super remote stations, like St. Helena, an island in the middle of the Atlantic, when I check into their station. Favorite song is playing from the far side of the gym. Believe it or not, it's Taylor Swift. Clicking around, American pop music is pretty common, possibly because it's the middle of the night in many of these places. Naturally, I also hear a lot about COVID-19.
For the second day in a row, there were no new community cases of COVID-19 in the country yesterday, despite a test.
That good news is coming out of New Zealand, obviously. This interactive tool makes time fly by. I'm getting tiny glimpses into what people listen to, like this song playing in Seoul, South Korea. Radio Garden has actually been around for a few years and has mainly attracted radio nerds like, well, me, who want to see what's happening on the global airwaves. But during the pandemic, Radio Garden has found a new audience. In 2021, this might be as close to international travel as we're going to get. Might I suggest checking out the radio in Fiji? Aside from auditory travel, people are using the tool to walk down memory lane, listening to their hometown radio stations while they're unable to visit in person. On that note, I want to check out the radio in my hometown of Perth, Australia. 98.5. Until I can travel again, it'll have to do. Spinning this virtual globe is the modern-day version of tuning your radio dial. And it's making this planet feel just a little bit smaller. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier. I don't know the meaning of all your words, but I know love.
That's where we sign off from Radio Planet this Wednesday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you tomorrow. With my collar up, I face the dawn. Before we go, just a quick reminder that now through June 14th, we are asking listeners to support our work. Your generosity helps power our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting with nuance and with care. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making a gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much. From PRX.